Hello and welcome. Hello and welcome, everyone. My name is Kate Johnson and welcome to
Radio.
Hello, everyone. I was talking to myself there for a minute. Hello, I'm Kate Thompson, and welcome to Kate Thompson Live here on GoPro Radio. Gosh, I'm really excited. Congratulations to the brand new food rap show there at GoPro Radio. 17,000 listeners. Wow. Congratulations, Gina. Congratulations, Shauna. Congratulations to Ayana for a lot of the recognition you've been getting over there. Wow, this is really, really fantastic. Boy, I'm telling you, GoPro Radio is really on a roll. Well, we have quite a lineup for tonight. You know, we're going to be talking to Bishop Jethro James, who is the pastor, the bishop from Paradise Baptist Church in Newark, and we're going to be talking to him about urban violence and the responsibility of the community and the church. We're also going to be talking about Trayvon Martin, and we're continuing with that case. We will never let up until justice is really done. He is also the chaplain of the New Jersey State Troopers, so therefore we have a lot to talk to the bishop about. We are also going to be talking to, of course, Eric Payne is going to be joining us, and my son Eric, he's going to be calling in. We're also going to be talking to Brian King, who is the attorney for Sonny Sutherland. I'm quite sure a lot of you know that name because of the fact that Sonny's children were taken away from him illegally, unjustifiably by the foster care system in New York. And Brian is the attorney. He's going to give us an update and let us know what's going on with that. So all these people we're going to be having call in. The case was on, May of 2013? We started that, or Sonny started that. His children were actually taken away from him out of the house illegally, unjustly, and taken away from him for a period of years. So we're going to be talking about that. We are expecting to hear from Bishop Jethro James very, very shortly. We have issues and hot topics, and the bishop is on the line right now. Hello, how are you, Bishop James?
I'm well, and how are you, Kay?
We're fine, thank you. It's so good to have you on again. We've had you on a few times before, and I have missed your voice and your dynamism.
Oh, thank you so much, and I've missed you. I'm just delighted and elated that you would even have me on. It's just wonderful. I was listening to your introduction and the congratulations that you were sending out to so many people, and want to echo the congratulations for jobs well done and work continuing in the field that's helping people.
Our new show on GoPro Radio has 17,000 listeners, and that was only in the first 2 weeks.
Wow. Well, that talks about who you are, and it talks about the quality and integrity of your show.
Yeah, well, that's not me. That's Shauna Glover and Nina. You know, I'll think of Nina's last name in a minute. You know, she's a little teeny lady, but God, did she, pack of power. She's a pack of powerhouse, I should say. But anyway, let's get to you. Now, you are a bishop. You are the bishop of Paradise Baptist Church, and that is in Newark. And you also serve as chaplain for the New Jersey State Police.
Yes, ma'am.
You've been appointed by the State Supreme Court of New Jersey, you know, as a member of the Attorney Legal Ethics Committee. So, I was also appointed to by the Supreme Court, by the way, of New Jersey, to serve as public advocate of the Ethics Committee some time ago. Well, that was some time ago, and I haven't done it in a while. I'll tell you about that in another time. But listen, Bishop, tell us about, you know, what's happening with this urban violence that's going on and the responsibility of the community and of the church.
You know, it's amazing to me when we look at the Trayvon Martin piece, and let me start there, and talk about, you know, violence in general. It's amazing to me that it took Trayvon Martin pretty much to open our eyes to the violence on our children. And not that we are not sympathetic to other areas of the country who have had major violence and death of a children, but our children die every day in the streets, every day. And the role of the church, I believe, is, number one, to call us to a consciousness, to call us to a point where the church has to speak truth to power and truth to ourselves. The reality is, especially in the African American and Hispanic communities, that the killing is not done by someone who does not look like us, someone who is not raised in our own home. Not too long ago, I had an incident in the church where the mother had found a .357 Magnum while she was making the bed of her son. And she called me, and, of course, I went down, and we found, you know, the weapon. And he came in, young man, you know, all of 120 pounds, raising hell. Well, back in my day, I would have got knocked out by my mother, beat to death by my father, and probably every relative in the family would have jumped on me. But we're not saying, and she was pleading with her son, where do you get this gun from, and dot. Now, just picture this .357 Magnum that he's walking the streets with, and he gets stopped in a routine stop, whatever, for whatever reasons. He's just with a bunch of kids on the corner. The gun falls out, or he's showing the gun. Or the gun goes off and kills him or someone else. I mean, and parents, too many of us are not saying anything. We don't want anyone to say anything to our children. We don't want anybody to correct our children. And we'll go out there and fight for our children. Some of the things we tell our children are ridiculous. And I think the role of the church is to tell the truth to ourselves. We should never leave home without looking in the mirror. The reality is, if you allow certain things to go on in your home, then you set your children up for failure. We don't tell our children you need to learn how to read a book. We buy them a video game so they don't bother us. I mean, and then that's the truth. I've had to stop people from actually coming to service, and they give their children a video game. And so now I'm hearing people, boop, 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 brrr. I'm hearing this in the service. And, there's 400 or 500 people in the church, and your child is disrupting the service. First of all, the video game has no place in the service.
In the church, right.
In the church, or the masjid, or the synagogue, or however you worship. It has no place. And so I believe the first thing that we need to do is talk to our children about the reality, and do some things that my mother used to say, manners will take you further than money. We need to teach our children how to respect themselves as well as adults. I believe
when you
that,
talk to when you talk to some of the children or some of the young teens in your church, those who might have at one time or another, you know, carried a weapon or something, how do you get them to see that they shouldn't do this, or they shouldn't even associate with people who are doing, you know, any kind of drugs or any kind of, you know, violent behavior?
Well, one of the things, they kind of think I'm cool. You know, I'm in my mid-60s, and I still ride my motorcycles. They know, you know, I'm down. If they need something or need help with something, I'll do my best to make it happen. If a child doesn't have the economic wherewithal, let's say that the church is doing some kind of trip or there's some kind of camp, then I'll go in my pocket and pay for it. And so from the time they were little, I was like the go-to guy. Many of them don't have fathers, and at my age now, I tell them I'm your papa, I'm your grand, and a lot of them do. I have some kids that call me Papa Bishop. That's the reality. And so I'm sort of halfway trusted, and they will come to me. They'll bring me a gun. They'll bring me a gun.
But, you know, I know there's a certain segment in the church, you know, the kids who are really, you know, kids who are more or less afraid. When I say afraid, you know, they're not going to say that they're involved with a gang because they don't want to be. In other words, they're the quote-unquote good kids, okay? They listen to their parents. Now, those are the ones who are also getting picked on at school. How do you deal with that?
Well, we've just recently had a class, and I'm fortunate because I am a chaplain with the state police, and we had a class for parents and kids on bullying taught by the state police. And so bullying is not something foreign to us. And parents were in a state of shock to recognize what bullying really is. We call it peer pressure. It's bullying. Take this, do this, do that, do this. And a lot of times the toughest guy on the block is not really that tough. without a weapon in his or her hand. The other thing is, Kay, I don't know if you're aware, but some years ago I worked as a chaplain in the juvenile justice system along with the prison system. So I had a lot of kids that I met in the system, and we stayed in touch. Some of them got out and showed up at the church, and we've been cool ever since because they're my experts.
Wow.
They're my experts.
So you can use them as more or less mentoring to some of the other kids, is that it?
That's it. And plus, these guys were tough as nails. These girls were tough as nails. They know what it is to do time. They know what it is not to be able to get a decent job. They know what it is to walk the street and look over your shoulder. And see, that's the other piece. Until we as a community start saying that the violence against us, perpetrated by us, is greater than the violence that is done by other folks to us. And until we start becoming, we've dropped the word neighbor and call our, where we live now, the hood. We're no longer a neighborhood. My, you know, God forbid, if my son broke into your house and all of a sudden I don't see anything because that's the way of the hood. We buy hot items from the hood. I know it was yours to start with. We carjack in the hood, and the majority of times we carjack the folk we know. I mean, when you
You know, let's talk about those kids and the parents, especially the women. You know, you get so sick and tired of having to, you know, be afraid for your teenage son, if you have sons. It's not fair, you know, to them to have to worry about somebody in a uniform who's supposed to be protecting everyone. Either it's a police person who's nasty and, you know, has racial problems, you know, with young blacks or young Latinos, and they will stop them unnecessarily. They will do all kinds of, like urging them to talk back or something like that, things that they don't do in the majority, you know, to white kids. And, you know, that's a terrible thing for a woman to go through. I had to go through that with my son, you know, make sure that when he went to school, you don't talk to this person. If a policeman stops, you keep your hands on the wheel, you know, don't even say anything, you know, that kind of thing. And it's so annoying. It's so annoying that, you know, as a woman, as a mother, really makes me so angry. I'm practically stuttering now because it does make me angry. I should not have to go through that. My mother should not have gone through that. My grandmother should not have had to go through that. You see what I'm talking about? Just because of the fact that your skin is different from the white person's? You know, and it's still going on. And you know, as a state policeman, I'm quite sure, you know, you came across a lot of that.
I come across a lot of it right now. If I'm in a suit and I'm dressed a certain way, but if I'm casual, you'd be surprised. Right. You can walk in the same building. Folks that recognized you when you were, quote-unquote, dressed up look past you when you walk into a building because you don't fit, quote-unquote, the profile. You fit the stereotypical profile. We still talk about that over the pulpit, and I have the responsibility under the full gospel. I'm the director, the bishop. I'm the director of all social action of the full gospel churches in the entire state of New Jersey. And that's one of the things that we talk about on a regular. We've got to teach our children how to react to the police. I have to know how to react. I've been stopped in towns, and it depends on what you're driving any given day or how anyone feels. And the last thing you want is to become a statistic and a mistake. And so I still talk about how do you respond to a police officer. We have to suppress sometimes our manhood, our womanhood. Shouldn't be like that, but we're still living the reality of America. Somebody said you have a black president. And what does that mean? You know, when it really comes down to it, what does that mean? Yes, Mr. Obama is in the White House. Yes, he is the president. But he won't get stopped. He won't get stopped.
But he has been stopped. But he has
earlier,
been stopped.
Earlier
because,
in his career, but he won't get stopped now. And so the reality is this, that you have to know how to deal with an officer, and if God forbid if he or she is having a bad day. You know, it shouldn't be like that, but people need to wake up. This is the reality. And then we do certain things. We dress a certain way. We look a certain way. We do things and don't understand why we do it. Some of the other things that really concern me, what happened to the big mamas and auntie and grandmama and big mama and them? Because they taught our young ladies and many of our young men how to dress, how to speak. You wouldn't just run around. You know, one of the things that bothers me on one of the news channels that really don't care for us, and we know they don't, but they did an actual factual survey. 70% of all babies born in the African-American community are born to unwed mothers, and the numbers are growing. And then a young mother, you know, you can't have a mother at 15 and a grandmama at 29. Mama didn't finish high school, and it's not expected that daughter finishes high school, and now she dresses Pookie, Ray Ray, or Shanae, just like you see on some of the videos, some of the negative videos. And so he or she grows up. She grows up with something too short. He grows up with his pants sagging. He grows up with a T-shirt too big. You're setting him up to look like what the system says is failure. You know,
But at the same time, shouldn't our kids feel free to wear what they want, to feel relatively safe because they're not doing anything and they're in their own neighborhoods? Like, for instance, I'm talking about Trayvon. What was he doing? Nothing but walking. You know, then you have this nutcase who shot him and committed murder, and nothing is really done about it. So therefore, you feel like telling someone, you know, well, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. You know, because that really makes you angry to have gone through this. It's enough of this. You know, when I remember, you know, when we were talking about Emmett Till, remember that? You know, Yusuf Hawkins, Rodney King, Amadou Diallo, and now Trayvon Martin. You know, it never stops. And pretty soon, you know, we're going to be in the vast majority here in this country. Then what happens?
Well, I really believe, Kay, that, number one, we have to go back to some of the older lessons that we learned during the civil rights struggle. We have, you know, they're getting ready to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech, and that's a wonderful speech, but they need to read his letter from the Birmingham jail, and that would tell us what to do, not only to feel good, not only about a dream, but how should we live, because the dream has really become a nightmare. We've allowed certain things. And as far as there's appropriate dress for all things, and forgive me for being at the old school, I don't need to see your underwear, the crack of your butt. That's not appropriate for any place.
Yeah.
If you're a young lady, as my mother used to say, if you're not selling, you don't go out advertising. So you can be decent, you can be sexy, you can be sharp all the time, but you don't have to be naked. And I really believe that, you know, I really believe that. So, yeah, you can dress within a sphere of decency.
Yeah.
In a sphere of decency, and I think that's key. The other piece that we need to talk about, and let's be real, we're the ones on TV calling our women a bunch of bees and a bunch of holes. Mm-hmm. We're the ones that disrespect. We're the ones that are saying it's all right. We're the ones that are saying get money, and predominantly through drug selling to our own people in our own community, and which has been the scourge of our community. And so we have to have a long conversation with ourselves, and the Trayvon Martins should be able to walk anywhere they want to walk, buy whatever they want to buy, do whatever they want to do. But remember that this is America. With what has just happened with the Supreme Court overturning voter rights, with who we have in the Supreme Court, with a Congress, with a Tea Party that doesn't really care about anybody, we're going back to, you know, the days of Jim Crow. As a matter of fact, I believe we're back there. When you look at, and nobody wants to be truly honest, when we look at, they talk about the founding fathers. Well, when the Constitution was written, you and I was not considered a person. You and I were not people. We were property.
Yeah.
And so until we learn our history, until we look at what brought us out, And I dare say your generation, my generation, we're the most educated group of African Americans in the history. And many of us did not come from educated parents, but they understood the importance of education. The dropout rate in the African American community is unbelievable. The dropout rate in colleges for us is unbelievable. And it's not always about economics. The other piece of it that's real crazy, when you look at the school systems in places, and we'll stay in New Jersey, Camden, Newark, Jersey City, Patterson, when we look at those numbers and the kids that graduate, and even the ones that are supposed to be quote-unquote top shelf, most of them need remedial work before they can even go to college courses. That's the reality of the world we live in. So we have to do something in our own neighborhood.
Yeah. I was reading in Time magazine, and I forget the minister who was saying that there has to be some, no, it was Calvin Butson, he was saying that there has to be some real changes. You know, you have got to really talk to, you know, these police persons. You know, you've got to really take a stand about what they can do and what they are doing. You know, for instance, I was reading this article, and it says racial profiling is the practice, according to this, the practice of drawing suspicion from skin color, and is publicly disavowed but remains widely practiced. And a Gallup poll this month found that more than one quarter of black men ages 18 to 34 say that police have treated them unfairly in the past 30 days. In New York City, for instance, a program called Stop and Frisk. Here you have Mayor Bloomberg, who credits, you know, the reduction in crime. So he says, you know, with allowing police to temporarily detain and search, get this number, 685,724 people, okay? And I remember talking to a couple of these young people who were stopped unfairly as they were going on the way to school, dressed fine, but they were males, they were black, and they were shoved up against the wall.
That's I've been there.
So the police have to come. The police have to work with us, and it doesn't seem like they're going to be doing that anytime soon.
Well,
until they're outnumbered.
I'll share this. Just recently, I was driving. I received a call from my major in the state police. I was pulled over.
Yes.
The officer got out of his car. He fixed his sunglasses. He fixed his gun belt. These were movements that were intimidating. And I just sat and waited for him. And when he came up to the car, didn't say a word, leaned in, and I was with my wife at the time. I just handed him my state police ID, and the look on his face, like I just ruined his day. And I spoke to him, and he said, "Sir, have a nice day." He didn't refix his hat. He didn't refix his gun belt or anything. It was, and I imagine he was saying some words to himself, like that we can't mention on the air. But gee, did I pick the wrong one to stop?
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely don't look like I definitely don't look like a thug. But it's real, and so we have to do some work with ourselves. But and that's one of the things that I thank God that I have access right up to the Attorney General and even the Governor.
Can you hold on?
Surely.
Yeah, can you hold just a minute? I think we might have to break for a commercial. I think I went beyond the time here, and we may have some people on the line. And I'm trying to have somebody let me know. Usually Shauna would let me know about that if it's time for a break. And is it time for the break? We have enough time, you say?
Caller.
Yes, hello? We have another caller. Okay, put them on the air. You're
hello?
On the air. Yes.
Hey there, Kay. It's Brian King.
Hi, Brian King. How are you? Bishop, this is Brian King, who is the attorney for Sonny Sutherland. Just let me tell you what's going on with Sonny Sutherland. And, Brian, you can stay on the phone with us and talk to the Reverend also. Sonny Sutherland is a friend of ours and really a key person with GoPro Radio and Black Wax Records. And his family was unjustly, illegally taken away from him years ago. under some sort of false something or other from the foster care system by a person, a worker in the foster care system, by a worker in the foster care system unjustly. And Brian, if you can pick it up from there and tell the bishop, you know, what's going on, you know, briefly, and then we can, you know, all join in this same conversation, because it does have impact on this. One impacts on the other.
Okay, well, the case with Sonny Sutherland is that Sonny had six children. They were all, like, relatively light-skinned. He had them with Puerto Rican women. They were good-looking kids. They were all in the house, and he was receiving some public assistance, although he had just got a great job, and he was going to come off public assistance because the children were worth something in the foster care system. That is, light-skinned children are worth more than dark-skinned children and a little less than
what?
White children. Hello?
The light-skinned kids are worth more in the foster care system than black?
Well, the fact is, for whatever reason, the foster care system, the lighter you are, the greater chance you have of getting adopted, the greater chance, the more people, families are interested and willing to adopt you because, you know, for whatever reasons, you know, historical reasons, I'm not saying it's justified, but it just so happens that Sonny's kids were light-skinned and good-looking, and because of the racial pathology in America, that made them valuable, so valuable that a social worker actually took them and thrust them into the foster care system to create some value for the city and to also, you know, so that the kids could be adopted out. I mean, it's a dirty game. That's what happened. They were kidnapped.
How
they
long,
removed.
How long were the kids in the foster care system?
At least 7 years, some of them, and one of them, I think, is still in the foster care system, actually.
Oh, okay.
One of them, she just turned 18 or so. And again, I'm not endorsing the pathology that would lead a family to prefer a light-skinned child over a dark-skinned child or a white child over a mixed child or any of that. The fact is, that is the pathology that is America, and that's why it's apropos to this conversation and to the larger narrative as to racial relations in America, you know, the idea of community delinquency and community pathology leading to crime and things like this, statistics conveniently culled together to make it appear that, you know, black folks are predisposed to crime. I don't think anyone ever asked the question, well, okay, if we see a scourge of white women dating, white women or teachers dating high school boys, that's a problem for all white women, and that's something that the white community, whether it be the entire white community in the United States, needs to address. It would seem like an absurdity to say that also that because you can find more white men who are engaging in white-collar crimes, that's a problem in the white community. The white community doesn't perhaps exist for the purpose of characterizing everyone on the basis of what a few of white people are doing. The white community doesn't exist at all, if you will. There's white folks are considered to be diverse and things like that, but black folks, because there's one guy in Brooklyn with a gun robbing people, then all black folks are supposedly predisposed to it, and it's a community problem. And this illogical construction is, again, part and parcel of that pathological racial narrative that we have in the United States.
Bishop James, would you care to jump in on this?
Sure. I agree with most of it. It is real. If you want to look at the child welfare system, child care system, I remember, I'm going back maybe 20 years. Again, a young lady from my church was involved in the system. Her mother was on drugs. She had a child, and they lived near the church. She came over, just to make the story short. She had been summoned to court, and they were going to remove the child from her. She asked me to go with her. I went with her. During my investigation, I found out that it was a Caucasian worker for the child welfare system, and this young lady, if she didn't perform whatever he wanted her perform sexually, well, then he wrote it up. After all, she was a welfare, young, black mother. Who's going to believe her? When I showed up in court for her, the switch got flipped. Judge, because of who I was, ordered an investigation. Now, she couldn't get anything done. And when it all came down, the system allowed him to retire. He had enough years with no harm, no foul. That's a true life story. I ran into her about a year ago. She's married, you know, family, dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
However, if I hadn't gotten involved 20 years ago, so how long was this child molested by the system, raped by the system? And the system wrote her up, and now we're in court, and really the wrong person was standing before the judge. And so that happens. And if you look at, you know, it's the good hair, you know, bad hair syndrome. It's the paper bag syndrome. And until we understand that that exists, you know, and then we had folk that were thinking, and come on, Kay, we're from Virginia. You know how our family is. You know, we come in all shades. There are places even now, and I'll think about the church that my father attended, which I won't mention, but the lighter you were, the closer to the front you sat.
Amazing.
That's amazing. Byron, so that's a stereotypical view that some of us have of ourselves.
What is the present, Brian, what is the present situation with Sonny? Now, he won the case. He went through all, Bishop about how many times he won and what the present situation is.
Okay, so the case was filed originally, I think, in 1997. Sonny filed it himself. He left his job after they took his kids. In an effort to get him back, he started studying law. He read law books. Although he didn't go to law school, he just read books. And he filed a federal lawsuit where he sued like 40-some-odd government officials, including the social worker that removed the children. The case was dismissed by the district court. It is a federal court in Brooklyn. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals, a panel of three judges, including Sonia Sotomayor, God bless her, they overturned that dismissal, and also they wrote in the opinion, hey, not only does they have the claims that Sonny had stated here, but they have additional claims because children, as we understand it, were harmed while they're in the foster care system. And so the case went back, and the city, also the panel, including Sotomayor, appointed or ordered the district court to appoint Sonny and the kids an attorney. Now, the kids and Sonny were appointing an attorney. Did you need to say that?
Hold on just for 1 second. I'm getting a text message from my son, from Eric. He is trying to call in, and he's getting some kind of crazy tone, he says, kind of like a fax machine. So, Eric, if you are listening, you know, try it again, and they will put you in, what is it, it's a QK, is it called, or what? You know, the waiting place, you know, for you to talk on the air. So try to call it again, okay? It's all that same number that you have to call in, okay? All right, can you continue, please, Brian?
All right, so the district court appointed the attorney for Sonny and the children. However, it just took a little bit of time before Sonny realized that that attorney was not working. And his or the children's best interest, it appeared that attorney was a saboteur of sorts, okay? And so Sonny distance himself from that attorney, although the attorney continued to represent the children. And Sonny and he both started, you know, litigating the case. That attorney received a lot of discovery. Discovery is an exchange of documents and information that before trial so that everyone can make the case. Sonny didn't receive any. Anyway, at the exchange of that discovery period, again, where Sonny received nothing, the city once again moved to dismiss the case, saying that, okay, out of all these facts, Sonny still couldn't win in front of a jury. It went back. The district court dismissed it. The Second Circuit Court of Appeal again reversed it, said, no, there's facts here that the jury might find.
What is it presently? What's the present situation?
Okay, so
where are we now?
After it went back, we went to trial on June 3rd. Now, I came into the case. That was June 30th this year. I came into the case about April 30th or so, about a month before trial. I went in, I asked for documents, I got none. It was clear that the fix was in, okay? So we went to trial with no documents. We didn't have exhibits, anything. But we picked the jury, and that jury, they listened. They heard the evidence, and at the end of the case, they went to deliberate. Now, when they were out deliberating, they started sending
minutes,
notes back.
Brian. Two minutes,
okay. The jury started sending notes back to the judge. The judge would read the notes. He wouldn't show them to us as he's supposed to do. And he characterized the notes as the jury was split. At some point, he got some notes from the jury saying we're at an impasse.
Yeah.
And he dismissed the jury and declared a mistrial. Outside, the jury's communicated to Sonny and to their attorney.
We will continue this. Listen, we will continue this at another time because I want to get back to the bishop now. I know that you have heard of these things before also, Bishop James, Jethro James, and I did want to talk to you about, you know, some of those cases that you've been dealing with on with the state troopers, you know, that a lot of people in New Jersey and elsewhere know all about. But listen, I'm going to have to tie this up right now. We have other callers on the line, and we will be getting back to you. Bishop Jethro James, can you come back?
Yes, I can.
Okay. All right, so we will plan to have you on again because I know you have so many stories. When I had you on before, it was so necessary that we talk to you. And this will be probably in about another couple weeks or so. Is that okay?
That's fine with me, Kay.
Okay. Thank you very much, and I will talk to you another time.
Okay. Thank you, and God bless you.
Bless you, too. Brian King, thank you very much. You want to hang
thank
on
you.
For a minute? And you know one thing? Attorneys are so long-winded.
I thought that was about preachers.
Don't you? Okay, I'm trying to find out if we have to take a break for now. You know, I'm not getting any cues from, you know, want to take a break? Can you say it in my ear? Yes,
no, we're
no?
not. You break.
No? Okay. No break. We're going to be continuing. If there's another caller calling in, we can put them through. I know that Eric is standing by also once again in on this conversation, but I don't know. He is calling the number that he is supposed to call, by the way. It starts with the 323 number. So if you can check that out in the control room, that'll be fun. But, Brian, listen, what direction are you going to be going in now while we're waiting for this, for Eric to get through?
Say it again.
What is the direction that you're going to be going in now? Because, sir, you won the case, right?
Well, again, I want to clarify that the jury went out, they deliberated, and the judge dismissed them, declaring a mistrial. But we learned outside, talking to the jurors, that there was just only one juror that was saying that he could not pass judgment. The rest of the jurors, there was a consensus that the liability had been established and that the amount, the proper amount of damages was $300 million. One juror, however...
Wait, the damages that Sonny would have gotten was $300 million?
Sonny and the children would have gotten $300 million, but one juror supposedly said that he could not pass judgment on someone. This is despite having taken an oath and sworn under oath that he could pass judgment at the jury selection process. And so we don't know why that juror either violated that oath when he said it or changed his mind.
Since he violated the oath, what has to happen? Can they throw that out?
So what was supposed to happen at the time, what was supposed to happen is there are alternate jurors, and that juror that had violated the oath, he was supposed to be removed from the jury. And if the judge would have merely just let us know, advised us, but the judge, for whatever reason, kept the notes from us, which, you know, perhaps constitutes official misconduct. We haven't raised these issues yet because we don't know exactly what the judge is thinking and what his rationale was, but we think it may be official misconduct. The judge was supposed to remove that juror, and the alternate was supposed to be seated.
Let's put a hold on this for a minute, and just let me tell people in the control room that if there is another caller on the line, would you just put them through, and then we can continue this. But if you can just put them through, it'll be absolutely fine. But I know that Food Rep usually does a commercial around this time. I don't know if you know about the new show called Food Rep there, Brian. It's absolutely fantastic. And they have 17,000 listeners, and they've only been on just a few weeks. Amazing, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, you want to continue from where you are?
And
I want people in the control room, if there's a caller coming in, just put them through.
So, $300 million, the jury wanted to give back. The judge was supposed to remove the juror that was obviously violated his oath or forgot it or whatever. But the judge, instead of letting the parties know or letting at least Sonny know, that is the lawyer representing Sonny, the judge kept the notes from us, which he was supposed to show us as an exhibit.
How in the world could they do that? Isn't that illegal?
Well, I'll tell you what. The amount of corruption that I'm seeing nowadays is absolutely appalling. I see more. Yeah, you know, and it's not like I've been practicing for 20 years. I've only been practicing for about 8 years. But I think starting with Bush v. Gore, I think a lot of
you're
legal
practitioners.
You're
getting quite an education, huh?
Well, yeah, I can recall taking a legal class in college, and my professor during Bush v. Gore, he was devastated that the Supreme Court had taken action it had taken in that case. But it was because at that time people had a higher regard for the courts and had a higher expectation of the integrity of the courts. Now, when you have a district judge that's willing to hide notes from parties, have ex parte communications, do things that are obviously illegal, and appear to be assisting a party, it really undermines anyone's confidence in our justice system or our legal system. You know, judges wear roles because they're supposed to be considered to be somewhat pious and divine, you know, not divine that they're gods, but they're supposed to have some type of higher wisdom, knowledge, and integrity. But those roles now, they kind of hang about them loosely because you see more and more people becoming judges who did it, you know, as a political opportunity, who did it by virtue of being a political opportunist.
What can be done? Now, you go into a court system, you know, to be treated fairly
right.
If you have a case, okay? And you certainly don't expect to be treated unfairly if there is a judge, you know, who is honest, and they're supposed to be honest. I think they take all those, oaths of office.
Right.
And so what the world are people supposed to think? What are they supposed to do if they cannot take a case to court and be judged fairly?
Well, yeah,
so
that's the
fundamental.
So what
does the community do? You know,
especially I really don't know the answer.
And you have an attorney, so what do you do?
I really don't know the answer. As a practicing attorney, I go into courts and I notice that judges are interested in cases. I know that judges aren't exercising independent discretion. There was a judge over in the Southern District of New York who was presiding over the stop and frisk case, and she stated that in New York City, judges aren't sufficiently independent of political pressures to actually make the right decisions in cases. That is, judges are scared to lose positions, they're scared that they won't be promoted, they're scared that they will be demoted, or that someone or that the city or some political factions will run opponents against them in their next election cycle. That is, people will lose their careers if they do not make decisions that favor the powerful political interest in this city, that is the city of New York. So, there is a big problem, and it's much bigger than that one litigant that goes in and there's a bad ruling one way or another.
Yeah.
When you have judges that are so scared that they're willing to hide exhibits from parties, they're willing to have communications behind a party's back,
okay.
They're willing, again, to throw out a jury verdict. That is well beyond any one litigant's control.
Okay. Brian, thank you very much. You know, and please keep us, you know, posted. And, you know, we will be checking with you again and again. And how is Sonny dealing with this?
Sonny, you know, he's cheerful. He certainly wants to get what he's entitled to.
Yeah.
The jury did want to award him money, so we're actually
fighting. Let me ask another question. What can the community do? What can the community do? For instance, in the Trayvon case, you know, I always ask, what can the community do? Well, you know, there's mobilization going on all across the country now.
If there can be some type of outcry, that's great. And if people, I think Trayvon makes us all pay a little more attention to the judicial system.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think we'll see more and more cases. I'm on a case now, a criminal defense case, and the complaining witness in the case claimed to have been assaulted by two black men. Now, he did that to inflame the passions of the jury and prejudice. But it turns out that the other person that the person who actually assaulted him was actually one white person. But it didn't come out. We had to bring it out through evidence and things like that. And so essentially, he knew that he get law enforcement turned against my client by claiming that two black guys assault me. And then it turned out that over days of testimony, he finally admitted no, it was a white guy. Not two black guys, but one white guy who actually do from the gym. This is the type of stuff that. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I was going to say I'm still waiting for another caller, and since I'm not in the studio, you know, this is very awkward at this particular point. But you know, there is one thing I want to be talking about before you go.
Okay.
And if there is a caller coming in, then I'd like them to let the caller come through. But the Amistad legislation. I don't know if you heard about that in New Jersey. That's a legislation that was passed that says that African-American history must be taught in the school systems in New Jersey. And I'd like to say congratulations to 50 teachers who went to and took the Amistad Institute, you know, classes. They attended the training. It was a four-day training session for educators in New Jersey. They were learning to include African American history in the curriculum, you know, the regular social studies curriculum. Now, the school districts, I asked, you know, the people in charge, school districts who do not implement the African American history, they will be reported to the State Department of Education, because this has happened in several districts in New Jersey, that even though this legislation has been passed and it is law now, it was signed by Governor Corzine before he left office. Whether he left, how he left is not the issue, but the point is he signed the legislation, and it is legal for, you know, the such social studies information, the curriculum, the history has to be taught in the school system. And these school districts that are not implementing the program, you know, they can be reported to the State Department of Education. You know, so that would mean that would really mean that they're breaking the law.
Right.
So, Brian, if you hang around, you may have a couple cases.
Well,
I'll take some. Yeah.
I'm
very particular about this. Because of the fact that African-American history has not been taught in the school systems. Some systems, yes. Other systems, no. It depends on where they are, even though they get the legislation says that you must do this, you know. And people who find that the information that is not being taught in their schools, they can call the executive director of the New Jersey Amistad Commission in New Jersey. So that's one thing you can do, and you could also, you know, the Department of Education you call and report them and get to the commission, which is very easy to do. You know, if you go on online, you can find, you know, the education commissions in any city or state, I should say, and then make your complaints then, because of the fact that this is a part of the curriculum now, and it is absolutely necessary that it's part of the curriculum, that you have to teach African-American history in the schools in the state of New Jersey. I'm not sure what it's like in New York. I don't even know if people are following through with that, but it's extremely important for our youth. It's extremely important to know about our history and the teachers. There are so many teachers willing to teach it, by the way, and so many are, but this is one thing that it's been made into law, so that's very important. I don't know if we have another, you know, caller on the line. I don't know if you can tell, Brian, are you still there or what?
Actually, I'm here. I haven't heard anybody else come in. Apparently, we have a technical problem.
Okay. We do have a technical problem with the phones?
Well, I just assume so because
are you getting that
I
indication?
It.
Yeah. That may be it then. That may be it. Okay. But anyway, you know, I was saying before that I was reading Time magazine, and they were dealing with this whole, you know, story of Trayvon Martin. And this was it was July, this magazine is July 19th, 2013. So there are several different articles in here, practically the whole magazine, you know, is dealing with it. Here's an article by Mayor Michael Nutter, who is, I'm sorry, I laugh every time I think of his name. He's a black mayor from Philadelphia.
Yes.
From
he's got an interesting name there.
I am sorry, Mayor, but the name is a little bit funny. Oh, you know that.
You're too much, Kate.
I don't
That's
mean
crazy.
To laugh, Mayor. I'll apologize when I see you.
Yeah, it's maybe a kind of unfortunate name, right? He's done the best he could with it, I guess.
Yeah. No, he's a very bright man. I'd like to hear him talk. You know, he's really good lecturer and a good mayor, I understand. Okay,
right.
Maya Angelou also had something to say in Time magazine. You know, they're talking about race and narratives and the reality. It's what happened to you when you were in, not law school, well, maybe it happened to you in law school. Did you ever experience any situations where race was an issue when you were in law school? By the way, what law school did you go to?
I went to Harvard Law School.
Harvard Law School.
Yeah, that was the only one that would take me at the time. You know how it is. I tried to go somewhere
else. Harvard
nice,
was the only one that will take you at the time.
No, I always just talk that trash. But,
yeah,
I went to Harvard. Well, you know, not just in law school, but all the time. I go in court. I've had times where white attorneys, I had a white attorney try to fight me in court one time.
You have got to be kidding. In court, in what
state? Oh, no. This was in Illinois, in southern Illinois, and, you know, they have a lot of sundown towns there. I don't know if you know what that is. That's a place where if you're black, you got to be out by the time the sundown goes down. And so I was out there arguing a case, and I made a good argument, and, you know, I was the only other black person in the courthouse except this guy that was pushing a broom, okay? And when I made the argument, after I made the argument, the attorney for the other side, he said something slick to me, and I kind of responded with, and he got in my face and said, "What you want to do, boy?" And, you know, the judge is right there. The judge is right there. It was
and
kinda,
the judge
it was,
said?
He kind of looked and grunted and then walked away.
He walked away? Were you in his courtroom? Were you in his court at that time?
Yeah, we had just finished, you know, a hearing in front of him. Or well, not a hearing, but some arguments on a motion. And, you know, the judge was going to take it under consideration. And that lawyer didn't appreciate my argument because he disagreed with it, of course. And you know, that's why we get paid the big bucks as lawyers, because we can disagree and that's why we're there, right? You know, one saying one thing, the other saying another. Anyway, he didn't like what I said, and of course he didn't anticipate that I would have as good an argument because people don't expect a black person to be excellent, you know, sometimes it's because of stereotypes. And so I caught him off guard, and of course he was just so offended, he wanted to fight, okay? And, you know, but I experience racial stuff all the time. The fact is I look kind of young and I go into court and I know a lot of legal rules and a lot of law. And so people don't always know what I'm doing because, I like to be excellent. And so other lawyers come in and they're kind of lazy and stuff. And I stand out and people are like, "What is he doing?" And it takes them a few days to get used to the fact that, no, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. The rest of y'all maybe need to step up your game a little bit. If you don't know these rules by heart, that's not my fault. That doesn't make me, that's not necessarily offensive. You shouldn't be offended by the fact that I come here and I do what I'm supposed to do and I take my oath seriously. But you'd be surprised how many people are offended by that and surprised taking it back that a black person is coming in there doing that.
Brian,
so that's
what should be done by the racial profiling laws?
Well, I don't know if you're referring to a specific state or
racial profiling, the same thing that Trayvon Martin went through, you know, in
Florida. Where somebody's looking at, I mean, just like in New York, you know, that's stop and frisk, essentially. It is looking at somebody and saying, well, statistically, you're more likely to do something. You know, I think those laws are bad in the sense that they assume that because somebody has a certain skin color that they're more likely to do something. That's not scientific. I think what's scientific is somebody is more likely to do something you can tell by based on their behavior, not based on how they look, but their behavior. You know, if there's a behavior that's suspicious, then, yeah, go grab them and ask questions. But if they just happen to be in public in the sight of law enforcement, they have dark skin or black skin or whatever, Hispanic, light skin or brown skin, that doesn't mean they're more likely to do something. Here's another interesting thing. People take the fact that there are more blacks convicted of crime as proof that blacks commit more crime. Well, you can't really reach that conclusion unless you can conclude that there's perfect enforcement and there's equal enforcement of the law.
Yeah.
We know that
yeah.
there are white folks often have more resources and avoid convictions more readily. And so you can't go and derive from the fact that there are more convictions of blacks the fact that they're committing more crimes. They may, in fact, be committing less crimes but being accused of more of them or being convicted of more of them because of a system that doesn't have perfect or even equal enforcement. And I think we can demonstrate that there's not equal enforcement across the board. I think we can demonstrate that the fact that I think you know that there are more white males committing, let's say, financial crimes than blacks, okay? That doesn't change the fact that the vast majority of white males that commit financial crimes are never brought to justice. Okay.
Yeah, of course.
So you know, a lot of those crimes can be hoisted onto the corporation that they're working for, and you know, corporations—you can indict a corporation, but nobody goes to jail.
Listen to this fact that's also has to do with the Zimmerman mindset, you know, why black men are the permanent underclass. It says today, I think this was by Michelle Alexander, she says that Today, millions of people of color are stopped, interrogated, and frisked as they're walking to school, driving to church, or heading home from a store, as Trayvon Martin was. In 2011, alone, the New York City Police Department stopped and frisked. Wait till you hear these figures. Frisked more than 600,000 people. Okay?
Right.
The overwhelming majority, of course, were black and brown men who were innocent of any crime or infraction. All right?
Right.
Their mere existence was cause for concern, just as the sight of Trayvon Martin walking leisurely through his own neighborhood was enough to make George Zimmerman call the police. Okay?
Right.
So what is to be done? I'll tell you what's going to be done. As Calvin Butts, as the Reverend Dr. Calvin Butts, pastor of Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem, said, that we are not in a post-racial society. He said, now, as far as he was concerned, he said, now is the time for us to push back. And then he says, I mean serious pushback. How do you react to that?
I think that a lot of the solutions that are being proposed, they really are a rehash of solutions that have been tried and that represent compromises. You know, someone's going to say, well, you know, we as a community need to look at ourselves and all that. You know, that's really just a rearticulation of a racial idea that somehow what some of us are doing or a few of us are doing really is the responsibility of all of us. The fact is that, you know, there are black folks in all walks of life. We're diverse. We're not, we're not a homogenous group. We are a diverse group. We have different interests, and we have different views on things, and we don't all agree on everything. And so the idea that we all have to rally together and somehow end crime in certain communities, I think that's inappropriate. I mean, crime being an economic problem, those of us that are doing well, it's not it's in essence, our responsibility to go into communities that aren't doing so well and tell them, hey, you shouldn't be stealing bread. And it's not also appropriate for us to feel embarrassed that somebody that's poor is stealing bread. A white person that's poor would steal bread, too, and that would be a rational act. Certainly, other white folks wouldn't say, well, we have to stop them from stealing bread. And so, no, I don't think the solution really lies, as many say, in us. And, you know, the we and the us coming together and solving something as a group because we all have similar skin.
Maybe not solving, right. But it's certainly reacting to it as a movement or continuing a new movement or, you know, building on that movement because the movement is going on in a number of states, I understand. Mm-hmm. You know, and it says we are going to have to go. I've finally gotten something telling me that we were going to be having to, get off the air and join us next week for K-Town Salon. Brian, thank you very much.
Well, thank you,
and
Kate.
I want
thanks
to thank
for having
you.
Me on.
Okay, thank you. And I want
right.
to also
Bye.
Thanks to Bishop James, you know, for hanging in there with us. And we will talk to you again next week. My name is Kate Thompson, and this is K-Town Salon. Join us again, everyone. Thank you.